Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Building Sustainability, the podcast that brings you interviews with designers, builders, makers, dreamers and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. I'm your host, Jeffrey Hart. Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of the Building Sustainability podcast. This episode, we are talking to Scott McCauley from the Anthropocene Architecture School. I am recording this on my first Monday off of my new 4-day-a-week schedule. I have been working many long hours this last month, doing an earth floor, as I discussed last week, and also some table and bench commissions, which I just handed over yesterday. So today I've used my first day off running around and sorting all the life admin that's built up. But going forward, every Monday is going to be my podcast day. It's going to be dedicated to finding new people to talk to, recording interviews, editing, promoting, and doing all of the things which make a podcast. So now, really, I guess I am part-time employed by this podcast, which is a slightly nerve-wracking thing. And that really only happens with your support. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can head over to the Patreon site. That's patreon.com/buildingsustainability. And you can get all the bonus content that's on there and engage with the production of this podcast. You can suggest some questions, you can suggest some people to talk to. I should take a moment to say a massive thank you to all of the Building Sustainability heroes that have already supported. Thank you so much for supporting this podcast. It genuinely makes a huge difference. I also wanted to say there has been some excellent feedback from the WIBS episode. So many people who do craft or are builders have given myself and WIBS feedback about the videos he made to accompany the podcast. Specifically, I've heard lots of feedback about the flexibility in people's arms and wrists. So if you haven't heard that episode and you do work with your hands, then I would thoroughly recommend you have a listen to that. So this episode, I've taken a slight liberty with the title of this one, The Rebel Architect. Scott is trained up to the part two of the three parts of architecture training, meaning that his job title is architectural technician. You can't call yourself an architect till you have completed the part three. He does correct me on this during the episode. So Scott is a remarkable young man. He's taken the Extinction Rebellion spirit and is disrupting his chosen profession of architecture. He's making a lot of noise to highlight the holes in architectural training and how it needs to focus on designing for the climate emergency. He's a tenacious chap. I first met him at the Big Strawbale Gathering, which was an event I organised for Strawbale Building UK a few years ago. Scott was talking at 100 miles an hour, bursting with ideas. it was wonderful to see someone so enthusiastic about changing the way things are done. So it was really great to catch up with him a few years later and find out what he's been up to. This is the last of my bank of recordings from lockdown. So there are a couple of references to it. Everything else from here on in should be pretty current. And we start with Scott discussing his recent experience on a course with another one of my podcast guests, Paul Allen, from the Centre for Alternative Technology. If you're new here, I'd recommend that you check that podcast out straight after you finish this episode. I'll be back at the end, but for now, enjoy. Was that the CAT course?
Yeah.
Nice. How was it?
Oh, that was fantastic. It was so good to like finally learn something really brand new and fresh for the first time in a while. And just to meet people again, they introduced you to people as you went. Mm-hmm. So we did like a coaching session with five people to like work on someone's idea and pull in everyone's expertise. And it started out, we had someone who'd worked in hotel and tourism in a kind of green sense, kind of doing carbon footprints for that, who was looking at a way of trying to take all the entry points into sustainability and make it more accessible. So we had myself, an architect, an arts and culture person from a council, and someone who'd worked with the WWF, all just kind of helping them refine this idea and giving it more kind of clarity and depth. And even just to do that on like at noon on a day just out of nowhere with people you've never had a conversation with really is exciting, and everyone's just in the same kind of excitable boat.
Nice. So why don't you tell me about the Anthropocene Architecture School?
So the Anthropocene Architecture School is a decentralized school of architecture, activism and climate literacy. So this school kind of, it's not a physical building. It started as more of an idea, then kind of grew very, very organically. But it supports kind of students, architectural practitioners, built environment professionals and educators in sort of catching their practice up to practice within the context of climate breakdown. And kind of word Anthropocene is kind of perfectly situated because it's that kind of change in geological epoch that we're experiencing. Uh-huh. So it just kind of contextualizes it quite nicely.
Nice. How long has that been going on?
It's been going on for about a year and a half, I'd say. So it kind of, the idea kind of came to me just as the kind of IPCC's special report came out in 2018. And then I had this idea, but I couldn't really put it into practice because I was on an exchange in Canada at that point. So when I came back from Canada, I was just kind of sitting thinking, no one in architecture responded to this in a really big and really urgent way. And in
responded
education...
Responded to the IPCC's report.
Yeah. So
tell us a little bit about what that says.
So the IPCC report pretty much said all the way back in 2018 that the difference in the impacts on people, planet, all living things would be exponentially worse if we go to a 2-degree temperature rise as opposed to a 1.5-degree temperature rise. So when I kind of heard this information, I was like totally floored because I've always had strong views on kind of the environment, always very passionate about it, care an incredible amount. And then the kind of whole world flipped overnight, but then everyone just got up and kept on going like nothing had happened. So in architecture, there wasn't really a shift. People were still designing buildings the same way they used to. They were still having award ceremonies about the same way they used to. And then there was no kind of change at all. So I kind of came back and was thinking, what can I do? Just like finishing up an architecture school, like I can't shift opinion hugely. It's like perhaps I could provoke some sort of shift. So in Scotland, we've got the architecture fringe. It's usually once a year, but it's now going to be once every two. And for the architecture fringe, you've got to issue a provocation, and then you host an event of some description. It can be in person. Now they're probably going to do things online in these circumstances. But back then, I thought, okay, so if I have 6 months, how much noise can I possibly make using social media and that sort of thing? Just kind of through different channels before launching this provocative school of architecture to kind of challenge this mainstream discourse of kind of keeping its head in the sand as much as humanly possible. So on the kind of 6th of June, my provocation for the architecture fringe was that the architectural education that is delivered to students today and that all practitioners have received historically is effectively obsolete in the face of climate change. We are designing in a context that we have not been prepared for. We don't, the buildings we design aren't, we don't really have that kind of same affinity with the climate that we used to as like traditional buildings would. So then before I kind of I had these words, so I was like, okay, this is what I'm definitely going to say. Like, this has to be the most provocative thing possible. Yeah. And then I thought, right, this is going to piss too many people off. So I need to have some form of data, some kind of backing to show like how, like what, where does it sit? So I decided, okay, for I have 6 months, I'll kind of survey students. I'll see how much do they really understand about sustainability in the built environment. So I did some surveys, I kept on going, I pulled together other bits like anecdotally, and then I used all these different, we measured all the different concepts around kind of sustainable design, so adaptive reuse, passive design, ecology, just little bits and pieces, and then once I got all the data and quantified it, the average understanding was 59%. So my kind of take was, okay, if we wouldn't let doctors practice with 59% kind of understanding, and we wouldn't let pilots take off, why should architects be allowed to design the buildings we live in? So we do it with the architecture friend. You have to go stand up in front of people and pitch your idea a few months ahead. So I kind of pitched this idea and they always kind of sat kind of a little bit of shock. And I was like, okay, we're going to do some like a survey right now. So if it's yes, stand up. If it's no, sit down. So I said, okay, how many people here know what the IPCC report is? So one person stood up and out of about 50 people, everyone else has sat down. I was like, okay, that this is bad.
Does Who are these 50 people, by the way?
These are 50 kind of people involved in architecture, students, practitioners. Okay. So out of 50 people, one person knew what it was. So I was like, okay, this is not good. So then I asked them, okay, stay standing if you've read any of it. And then they sat down. I was like, oh no, this just got bad. And then after that, I said, okay, so I've now kind of went through how bad climate breakdown is. Please stand up if this worries you or you're scared about it. And the entire room just stood up. So we had 100% of people are really worried about climate change, but people don't know what's happening with it and don't feel prepared to kind of practice and change to keep up. So then I found I got an insanely positive response for telling people their education had become obsolete. I got lots of people very, it was really positive. It was really friendly. I've never been involved in the architecture fringe before. I was like, I'm not going to be very popular telling them that they've not been educated properly. And then I got this really warm reception of like, this sounds like a really necessary thing. It sounds great. Like, what else are you going to do with it? Where's it going to go from there? I was like, I hadn't really got beyond making lots of noise and annoying people. I just thought we were going to kind of, then from there, I was like, okay, what can I do to make this instantly useful, but continue kind of dialing up the noise? So I then, in the lead up to the architecture fringe, put together a kind of guerrilla reading list. So the reading lists we get given are typically lots of modernism, lots of Corbusier, lots of Fieri, but not much about how buildings really work.
Hang on, just go back. I know modernism. I don't know what the other on the list are.
Okay, so on the kind of the stuff we typically get recommended is architects at practice to kind of like 60s and behind, maybe 80s if you're lucky. Or you might get a tutor who likes a lot of kind of postmodernism or, but you don't really, it's entirely dependent on your tutor. You could get a tutor who has no idea about sustainability. You could get some who's like a bit of a hard nut and really passionate. So the reading lists we typically get given, they don't really prepare you at all to practice and bear sustainability in mind. So I thought, okay, what if I go through all of the books that I've read that I found most useful in the past year, just found 30 of them, line them up, and I'm going to just tweet out a reading list and just tag the author and just pull as many of these together as humanly possible. So I did this for a month, and by the end of the month, I had people from Australia getting in touch with me, I had people from the States and all parts of the world. I didn't think what I was doing was making any noise, but as soon as you start using things like social media to do bits and pieces, it just seems that it's quite a good way to reach out now, and that's kind of just grown. Then it got to the fringe itself, and I'd been inspired by an idea I'd seen in Canada where I was on exchange. So it was a thing they had called a polylog. So it was a dialogue with more than one person. So I thought, right, if I want just to discuss with people, what do you think about the education and where does it sit and how should we teach it and what's missing? So instead of me saying, I think everything is absolutely shit and I'm going to correct it myself, but okay, I'm just going to open up a forum. We're just going to get all the feedback. We're just going to let people talk and voice their opinions. I'm just going to be the kind of receiver of this, write it all down and work it out, and then kind of collate it and see where to go next. So I kind of intentionally chose a building in Glasgow that's the oldest Victorian music hall in the world. So the Britannia Panopticon, for a very overtly atmospheric background. So I wanted the weirdest possible, just take it away from architecture. It's not going to be stripped back in white. It's going to be as kind of characterful as possible. And as part of booking this space, your money goes directly towards the restoration of the project. So I thought, okay, this is quite a nice narrative for the first thing the School of Architecture is ever going to do is host a conversation that's going to directly kind of help repair this really beautiful and incredible building that most architects in Scotland won't visit because it's not on their radar. So kind of from there, kind of did the event, got quite a lot of feedback from people. And then people said, okay, like, what's next? Like, what are you going to do? Like, this is something that's really lacking and missing. And then for a few months, I got kind of very wrapped up in the goings-on of Extinction Rebellion in Scotland and just kind of occupying our parliament and bits and pieces. And then there was the opportunity in, I think it was during the Edinburgh Fringe, Extinction Rebellion had a place that basically said, Summer Hall had said, we'd really like you to put on like a full programme, but what can you do? And then a couple of friends of mine said, oh, you could do something with the Anthropocene Architecture School and build upon what you've been doing. I was like, I don't really know what I can do for the Fringe at all. So then had a bit of a brainstorm. It's like, okay, so we've got cities all around the country making a declaration of a climate emergency, but no one's got a plan. No one's really got a clue at this point. What if I was to put together a workshop that would kind of like a hackathon, put lots of people in a room and really fast problem solving, but intentionally mix them. So you're not just going to put architects in a room, you're going to put architects, activists, engineers, local councillors, intentionally got some of the Youth Strike for Climate as well. So just to kind of make it as broad a range as possible. So people from Friends of the Earth, we had the president of the RIAS in Scotland. So that's the Royal Incorporation of Architects in Scotland. So we had this like president of that, with quite a few architects that I'm kind of friends with as well. We had the author of the first ever sustainability accreditation in architecture, Sandy Halliday as well. And then so we had people from Extinction Rebellion facilitating all these small discussions. So it designed out the architectural kind of urge to kind of manifesto and just kind of dominate the floor. So I kind of designed that out. So we had it as accessible as possible. So we used kind of like hand signalling to make sure everyone got their kind of space, to make it as accessible and kind of equal as possible. And then this got picked up by a newspaper during the...
What was the topic? What were you trying to sort of solve?
Kind of solving, it's like how the kind of question put to everyone was, what is standing in the way of your city becoming climate emergency ready? And it was all broken down into like headings. So one was looking at infrastructure, one was looking at built environment, another one was looking at public space, another one was looking at kind of energy as well. So we had these four tables of each of a different kind of topic. And then we had one facilitator per table. And then we had, so we had all these different people with different expertise. It wasn't inherently their area of expertise. So when you've got that kind of curiosity from people, you get a bit more of a wider imagination because they've not been honed into that specialty.
Yeah, they haven't been sort of trained to think in a particular line.
Yeah, so we got some really broad answers and all these things came back. So I was like, okay, I'll collate all this and then we can kind of put it out and people can then pick it up and run with it themselves. So they can take all this back to their own groups and say, okay, this is something we can actually aim towards, or this is something we can demand, or here's something we can work with.
Right. What sort of things came out of it?
We had somewhere in kind of retrofit in the built environment, there's quite a lot kind of standing in the way of that. So there's like the extra VAT on retrofitting buildings. So it's like some lobbying ideas came out of that. Mm-hmm. As far as public transport, there was the very kind of very fast, like nationalise everything now, and all the kind of typical bits and pieces. And then mm-hmm. there was just some really different bits and pieces. We had some people came back instead of filling in this kind of problem, solution, action point. They came back with all these diagrams and graphs of here's where our ideas sit in terms of how radical they are and how practical they are. And everyone just came back with these really colourfully different approaches to solving problems. Mm-hmm. So then the best part was everyone said, I learned more in this 2 hours than I have like on my course than anywhere else. Just having all these people, it made this really kind of great space for cultivating just knowledge and picking things up, people teaching each other. And it broke down any kind of barrier between I'm an expert and you're not an expert. Mm-hmm. So it meant everyone was on this kind of equal footing. And then from there, I ended up doing the same thing for the Rebel Rising Festival in Aberdeen. So we had some local councillors, ended up meeting some decarbonisation experts they'd never met before. And it was just, again, this totally different mix of people, where people who worked in economics. We had some people who had just seen it in passing on the street and said, I saw some extinction symbols and came in and this sounded interesting. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, people, just the conversations they were having. I was just kind of going around the room, trying not to influence it too much, and just hearing people start like, oh, we need to stay in touch. Here's my contact details. Let's like follow up on this later. And it was just this really lovely space that was really buzzing with ideas. And I hadn't set out for that to happen, but it just... it grew from just trying to get people thinking about the climate. Then from there, I unexpectedly got asked, could you take... So the president of the RIS approached me and said, the presentation you gave to explain the climate breakdown, the climate emergency, was the clearest I've ever seen it. Would you be up for doing this for our national convention? We really want someone to set the tone and make it as clear and as plain as possible for everyone to understand. And I was quite kind of surprised because I'd never spoken at a conference before. I've done stupid number of talks just here and there, but I'd never been asked, can you come to this very formal, very traditionally architectural space and just go for it and break down where we are now, where we need to go. So I kind of stripped out as much of the kind of not even superfluous, but just distilled this into kind of, I told you I have 10 minutes to say everything.
Like, right, that's not a lot of time to spell out people's doom.
Yeah, so I had the kind of dilemma of, do I go up and then do 10 minutes and know that I've not done enough, or do I prepare half an hour and then refuse to leave and just kind of keep piling on? So I kind of sat and thought, will I get blacklisted for life if I just really screw this whole thing up for everyone? I was like, no, this can't go too seriously wrong. So I prepared half an hour. And then it turned out that the two people before me had actually intentionally made theirs concise to give me a bit more time. But then I kind of explained kind of where we are in terms of climate change. I then explained just how significant the built environment is. So like 39% of all carbon emissions on the planet are entirely attributable to the built environment. Mm-hmm. And that's huge. So it means everyone working in architecture has this huge responsibility to be kind of stewarding that to be as low as possible so they can have the most positive kind of potential.
And that, so that 39%, is that buildings construction, buildings in use?
The kind of buildings in use, so operational carbon is 28%, mm-hmm. and the embodied or upfront carbon is 11%.
Okay.
So that's how significant the built environment is. And architects are perfectly placed between engineers, contractors, clients. We're not master builders anymore, but we're still really well placed to kind of champion this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But then in Scotland, we've got the kind of this sustainability accreditation. So this is an accreditation that's peer reviewed that shows that you have a knowledge and an expertise in delivering sustainable buildings. So I thought, okay, what if I find out how many people out of all the architects in Scotland have this? Like, surely it's at least a decent number. Mm-hmm. But then it came back and it was less than 3%. So
less than three?
less than 3%. So I thought, I'm going to put that on the biggest possible screen in Edinburgh in this presentation and just include it. And there was just this kind of, there wasn't even like a murmur or a giggle. There was just like total silence. And this was just this. And I said, in a climate emergency, that's simply not good enough. Like, we are not just kind of slightly failing the future generations in this respect. Like, we've gone as far as betraying them as not really trying hard enough. And so I kind of ended on not so much the usual, but I went through and broke down, like, we really have this responsibility and we should be doing so much more. In terms of being a climate emergency, we're not pulling our weight yet. And then I went off and I sat down and I was like, have I overdone it? Have I maybe said too much? You shouldn't tell an entire profession they're actively betraying future generations. And then I got this, again, insanely positive response. So I had so many people coming up to me like, oh, you said that so well, or I've never seen it put that way before. I'm a little bit scared. And I really expected it to just bomb. I was fully prepared, like, okay, this is going to go terribly. I'll just have to get out and leave. But I had so many people coming up to me to just say, like, thank you for saying that. Like, we really need this kind of urgency and we need people to just cut straight to the point and not tiptoe around it anymore. And I've been very, very lucky. I've got friends in the Climate Psychology Alliance who helped me kind of not so much tone myself down, but just tailor it with the right amount of impact and the right amount of positive uplift at the end. So I have people who, it's not so much they're tactless, they're trying to improve it as much as humanly possible. And if I go too far into doom or gloom, they tell me. And it's just, I thought, okay, so many people feel so strongly about this. Why is nothing happening? And I've, as part of kind of sort of sarcastically raising the profile of the Anthropocene Architecture School, I thought, okay, so I've got all this kind of climate and literacy that architects apparently really, really want. And I also need to make sure this school of architecture can run. So if I do a crowdfunder and say, I will come to your office and I will, in an hour, in your lunch hour, I will teach you just the foundational basics and give you a basic fluency in kind of climate literacy and why your work is so important. And I thought, right, nobody's going to pay for this at all. Just, I'll just very, very sarcastically put a number, say, if you pay me this much money, which is more than I've been paid for numbers work in my life. And then I had people come back and say, can you come and do this? We want to conference call this to all of our offices. So then kind of go to the architects and go through this kind of climate literacy. And
what do you mean by climate literacy there?
So climate literacy in the same way as like a fluency in numbers or in language or even like an environmental literacy, like understanding how the environment works. Climate literacy is about the kind of the immediacy of climate change and the urgency behind it, the history. So it's not something that just kind of magically appeared when Greta went on strike. And it's a timeline that we've been able to chart back decades, even centuries, when scientists have mentioned things. It's also understanding the kind of the intergenerational injustice behind it. So the way that it's going to affect the young so much more than it's going to affect the old. And it's also injustice in the sense that the global South and the Indigenous North have been facing the impacts of this for decades. It's not a new thing to them. This has become an everyday part of their life. And then it's also this understanding where your work sits within that wider kind of system and being able to place the kind of what positive impact can I have within the built environment? Because the built environment is multifaceted. There's so many aspects to it. But it's just understanding what can I do that's positive. But then it's also recognizing that people have an emotional response to climate change. And it can be incredibly powerful. It can be just total knockback and denial. It can be grief. It can be kind of eco-anxiety. So I also thought, right, if this is going to be taught, it has to be taught in a way that's very respectful of that. It has to be very mindful, very, very much inspired by Extinction Rebellion's idea of a regenerative culture. So it's really, it's honouring those feelings. It's when you're teaching people, always giving them the space to raise a hand and say, I'm quite overwhelmed. Can we stop for a bit? Or I'd like to question this and know more. Or just how do you kind of process this? And you always have to kind of give, is this about giving people the tools to not just be given a solution and expected to kind of, okay, you've been told that Passive House exists, that's great, but it's about giving people a pathway towards solutions that they can kind of work towards. So I thought, okay, this is this. I've got this. And when I started using the term climate literacy, the conversation with people just overnight changed. It was less about people, oh, we all know this. This is, it's implicit in our work. We always do sustainability, to, I don't know this, or I've never heard this bit before. I'd really like to learn more. Where do I go? What do I read? What, who do I speak to? Mm-hmm. So when you term it as a literacy, it's a much more, it's not as much an even playing field. It's people really want to be fluent. They want to kind of, they want to understand. And there's this thing that it's been in the background, and a lot of people have found that they might have seen things about climate change, but they don't know where to go to look to read more. So they get a terrifying headline and they're like, I can't contextualize this personally. I don't know how it impacts me, or how does my work relate to this? So kind of just from there, that literacy, and it just developed from there very organically. So because I've done quite a few talks for Extinction Rebellion, when I was in Canada, I studied international sustainable development as alongside architecture. So I had this incredible professor who'd worked for the UN, who every week would not so much tease a discussion out of us, but he would just so subtly get everyone to feed in their sort of view on a topic from, I really coincidentally got given the Brundtland Commission, so Our Common Future, the first ever report that kind of spoke about, it defines sustainable development and why it's so important. And then from there, we got given this timeline, and it was just a timeline of every single warning, every single red flag, every single climate disaster, just on three pieces of A4.
Yeah.
And his mind was just entirely blown. I was like, how can, as a species, we ignore this? Like, how do we, surely if people realised how many times it's came up, that might help a little bit. So I just kind of, I brought all of this kind of, all this information and just distilled it over a few weeks. I just thought, how can I, it has to be spoken about as a narrative. It can't just be the hockey stick graph and saying this is terrible, or you can't just kind of show people information and say we are totally doomed and you're doing bad things in your behavior. You can't do that. It doesn't work. So I kind of, with this kind of climate literacy, I did it for a couple of architects, and then I was approached by the Glasgow School of Art. Their sustainability officer said, right, we could give you space to do a 4-hour version of that. How much of this can you, how much do you know that you can teach? So suddenly I had four hours of potential teaching that I could use. So I just kind of sat for a few weeks, well, not sat, I really, really intently dug into everything I've worked with before and just pulled together all this, like the kind of the narrative of the history. So going for all the kind of key moments and breaking that down.
Key moments such as what?
There was a Silent Spring in the 1960s that kind of spoke about the use of pesticides and how that was impacting kind of the climate. There was the Closing Circle. So a Barry Commoner, an ecologist, wrote about, he defined these four laws of ecology. And before the kind of plastic pollution was ever a thing, he predicted that every synthetic material that we develop is not going to biodegrade because the planet hasn't developed like a digestive system for it. And he broke it down in so simple terms. He was predicting a climate crisis. I think he might have even used the word climate crisis. And then from there to, in 1992, there was a, Greta Thunberg was not the first kind of young climate activist to speak at the UN conferences. And this was the girl who silenced the world for 5 minutes because she, this Canadian girl, they'd raised money for their kind of eco kind of group, and she spoke really passionately and said, like, you're not giving us a future, and if you really cared you wouldn't be doing this. And for 5 minutes there was silence, and then there was the polite clapping, and the UN went back to just doing as before. And
yeah,
we've seen, then it comes in 2006, there was the Stern review. So this was a review that said that if we act on climate change right now, it's going to cost about 1% of global GDP. If we don't act on climate change, it's going to be at least 20 times more expensive to deal with just the impacts and not even to sort it. So 14 years ago, we got told, by the way, guys, it's going to, the economic argument of not acting is bullshit, and we should definitely do it immediately and just get stuck in. And then there was all the, in another one in 1992, Shell, so the big, the carbon major, one of the biggest oil companies in the world, produced a movie called A Climate of Concern. So Shell was telling us we should be scared about climate change and all of their, and it's totally mad. And we've got all these things, but it's just not been spoken to people. We've not had that narrative offered to us. The narrative that we've been given is one of, you are responsible for changing your behaviour and that's it. Or you should write to your MP. But then last year, Extinction Rebellion and other groups, particularly the Youth Strike for Climate, just totally blew that conversation out the water and said, we need to act immediately. There's so much urgency. There's, if we listen to the science on this, to not act is not just irresponsible, it is incredibly disrespectful. And it's the moral imperative to act is just, it's so powerful. And personally, for me, I kind of last year, as I started getting stuck in with Extinction Rebellion and as kind of all the circumstances aligned, I suddenly felt this huge grief about the climate, and it just kind of, it hits you all at once in the same way as losing someone you care about. You just get this sudden realization of the future that I've been told I'm going to have isn't going to exist.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that was all from there. So this kind of climate literacy workshop developed, and then I ended up getting architects. We got people from the NHS came along because they wanted to understand how their built environment fit into kind of health impacts and climate change. We had students, we had dancers, we had engineers. And it was just so many people wanted to learn and were willing to just sit for four hours. There's an hour in the middle for a lunch break and a detox and relaxation. But so many people want to learn and want to understand because this literacy has not been in any of the education we've been delivering. So it's just been this big missing aspect.
Yeah. I want to talk about that for a minute. But what sort of... So you're a part two architect, is that right?
Yeah, part two. So I'm not a fully accredited architect. I can't legally put architect on my name.
Yeah.
Legal implications, but part two architectural designer keeps it nice and fair.
That's what I meant to say. So you've done 5-ish years of education?
Yeah, 5 years.
And what sort of sustainability or, you know, environmental design stuff was part of that?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Very, very little. So it's the kind of the usual line given is, oh, it's implicit. They don't spell it out, but it very much always feels to be like a bolt-on. Like you tick the box, you tick the sustainability box maybe once or twice a year, and that's kind of it. But it always, for me, it felt very, very lacking. And I spent more time going outside of university to learn from other groups and to go to other places to learn in other ways because I just felt I wasn't being prepared to practice as a kind of sustainable designer.
I have a constantly shifting view of architecture or architects, I guess, in that my current view is sort of that they're designing spaces more than they're designing buildings. Do I believe that? Is that what I really mean? I think it seems like that's more of their focus, and then some aesthetics. And so the actual sort of fabric of the building and really pushing environmental, you know, highly insulated, airtight buildings isn't something that really falls within their world, I guess. Is that a fair or is that not fair?
I'd say it's, if you're to talk about the education, that's very, very fair. That's
right.
That very concisely. You've got, there's there are architects who are incredibly clued up on this, who are just amazingly on the ball and have been pushing this for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, it does really feel to, in the kind of the education that they prepare people for, they don't really, you don't go in very much into like materials. You don't, your technology is maybe this exists, this has been done, or maybe you should consider. It's not mm-hmm. really a in-depth, this is the material, this is how it's kind of, here's how you detail it very well. Like, we didn't get classes on how to like detail that sort of thing. We didn't do, we did one hands-on like kind of construction project. It was build a small shelter slash pavilion-y thing. Mm-hmm. And then we'll knock it down in 2 weeks.
Right.
There was no, like, here's how you build a standard wall. Here's, there was none of that. And it was, it really just felt so left out. And I got very interested in hempcrete as a material and just found that even our technology tutors and engineers had no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And couldn't, I was asking for help, like, can I do this with this material? And like, I have no idea. Like, so I'm, okay, so I'll go and just read more books then. And then my kind of feedback at the end of that year was just like, this is nonsense. It doesn't exist. That's not a thing. So it's like, okay, I've literally just read the hempcrete book. I'm pretty sure that's a thing. So I went and took a course with Alex Sparrow in Brighton, the Brighton Permaculture Trust, mm-hmm. as kind of introduction to hemp lime. I spent 2 days learning there and then said, okay, so I can now build with hempcrete. I now know it's real. This is great. Are you going to be in Scotland at any point? Is there any building I can do? Because I really love to just get hands-on. I'm a hands-on learner. I don't, visual and hands-on. If I don't build something like at least once a year, now I get cabin fever and bounce off the walls a bit. So I said to Alex, okay, so I'd love to get involved in the project. And he kind of looked a bit kind of sad and went, we're not got coming to Scotland for quite a while, but we've got a project in the French Alps, and if you can, it's a bit far away, but they're offering to pay for people's accommodation. So if you can pay to get there, then you can just learn. So I thought, okay, this is definitely the best use of a student loan. I'm going to dive off to Le Contamine on Montjoly. I'm going to learn from these people. So I get there. There's just this incredible free story. All timber frame, there's nothing but the frame at this point. There's just mm-hmm. the timber frame. You can see through it in places. You can climb up to the third floor and look out what will be their living room that's just across this beautiful valley. You can just see the kind of peaks of mountains. And then they had all these different craftspeople from all around Europe, all around the world. So we had an architect from India. There was a carpenter from Spain. There was an architectural graduate from Belgium. There was a lime and clay plasterer from Portugal. There was an environmental engineer from Prague. And there was just all this knowledge going around. And then the second part of the week, there was an ecological builder from Bristol. And all of this just like David Copeland's. So Auckland, Auckland Construction.
Yeah.
So here's me just kind of this super like energetic and passionate, suddenly found that this is just what I want to be doing and getting stuck in. And I went from, have you done joinery? Yes. Please, can you put up a cladding system? Like, here's how it works. Just go up on the scaffolding. Totally fine. Just don't fall off and we're good. And it was just, it was incredible. It was the best. I learned, I can still recall conversations whilst we were pouring hempcrete and tamping it down. I was kind of grilling this environmental engineer, is like, what can I do with round earth? Like, he's like, you can do floors with it. I'm like, how do floors work with round earth? So I was able to ask every time I didn't understand something, I could just ask. And the people having the self-build done, so this couple were so clued up on sustainability and materials, and the wife was a sustainability consultant and the husband was a carpenter, used to be a commercial artist, and they were just so receptive to everything, and they encouraged us to go and explore and see things. And we'd start the day at kind of You'd think starting at 8 in the morning, like on the bottle, the dot was kind of, oh, that's an early start. But you'd wake up and it was just crisp and beautiful and the sun was everywhere. And even if it was raining, it's not Scottish rain, so it's really nice. It was just like warm on your skin, kind of rejuvenating sort of experience. So I was been a week and a half kind of just building this hempcrete building. I was like, wow, this is absolutely incredible. So kind of came back to Scotland, resubmitted the same work with some photographs, pretty much just saying, this is what doesn't exist. Pass me, please. So I got passed by 1% and told not to do that again. So I kind of laughed at them a bit. And then I went into my next year. I was like, okay, so I really want to learn this stuff. So I'm going to get involved. I got told in Brighton to get involved with CEDA. So that's the Scottish Ecological Design Association. Mm-hmm. It was Kirsty Castles who recommended I get in touch with them. And they do kind of events and talks and lectures. So suddenly I had a kind of a community of people. It wasn't just me, the one student doing green weird things. It was all these people who've done careers out of green weird things, who are super happy to teach and to support and to encourage. And then, so when I wasn't getting that education in uni, I was getting it outside of the architectural design studio. I had these people that I could just ask questions to, who were incredibly supportive. And then it just kind of blossomed from there. I kind of loved the technical side. And even though I wasn't being given it, and it wasn't being delivered to any extent that would set you up to practice incredibly well. But it was just, oh, I had suddenly felt, okay, I now know where I can learn. And then I went on to do a short course and then help Hawkland Ecological Construction do part of a build for a straw bale barn office in Exeter. And that was an incredible kind of a break from looking for jobs just after Brexit, where it was incredibly, there really wasn't, I think I sent out 130 job applications in one summer, and
wow,
it was not a fun time to try and be an architectural assistant. But I got this therapeutic break building with straw bales in the sun, which was so much more enlivening, and I learned so much more than I was getting in uni. So that was my kind of architects there, although to be very, very fair, there are lots of architects right now who are pushing a lot more on the kind of, they want to clue themselves up, they want to push in the environmental side. Mm-hmm. So there's the Architects Climate Action Network, and they've been doing some lobbying on kind of feedback on regulations. They're doing lots of upskilling, they're kind of sharing knowledge and trying to bring that into the profession. But we've still got this kind of block from the traditional education that's saying, oh no, we're doing that anyway. Wait, everything is fine. We can just keep going.
Mm. So it's the phrase at the moment is business as usual. That's a shame. I mean, it's good that people sort of on an individual level, or maybe on a practice by practice level, are, you know, wanting this information. How do you think you can change the educational facilities?
So with the education, I had another kind of point where I was like, okay, so I've got this data that says students don't know very much. So I need to build upon that. I can't just mm-hmm. say I've done one study. So as part of what I've been doing, I run the Crisis Studio. So this is a studio for students where I, through kind of my own network of kind of friends and peers, we get a multidisciplinary team, and we use the students' ongoing projects as like the armature to teach them more sustainable design skills.
Right.
So it's a kind of sort of like a peer review, but at the same time, it's just giving students what they want to learn. And it's mm-hmm. also giving people in practice the opportunity to share the skills that they have built up over their careers. So uh-huh. At first you'd think that, okay, you've told people they can have a tutorial. It's going to be it's going to be like going into a university, but it's very informal. People get really energetic. You see students some students will come after they've been at uni for like 6 hours, and they'll come to this and they just kind of wake up and are like, one person said, I learned more in 15 minutes than I did in 2.5 years. This is great. When's the next one? And you just get so the positive response from students, like, this is what I want to learn. Thank you so much for doing this. When can you do another one? We need this.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay.
Can I just to sort of summarize what I think you're saying is, so you get groups of architecture students who are working on a university project.
Yeah.
And they come and sit together in a room with other students and professionals in the sustainability world. Is that right?
Kind of. It's sort of a spin on the like traditional like kind of pin-up. So they kind of they come into the space and they just cover the walls with their projects. Okay. And then these professionals kind of go around and just, instead of it being in architecture school, it can be very subjective. So your tutor might not like your project because it's not like their work, or you might have a different ethos. But when you take that subjective side away, and you have people who are really keen to learn, keen to share, organically you get this kind of buzz. And we get some architects will bring like a materials library from their office. So it means the students are able to see what their built project would be built from. Mm-hmm. And I bring parts of this kind of reading list that I've made. So we've got like a small, it's not really a library. It's just a really spattering of books that could be useful for a tutorial. And they kind of, all the projects get pinned up and they kind of go round and round. And they get this instant feedback from people who've done this in practice. And sometimes we get people coming who are looking how to get involved in sustainable practice, and they don't know who to go and talk to. So this is an opportunity for them to just have that ask, because there's not really, through the university system, there's not a really good link to practice in that respect. So there is for business as usual, it's totally fine if you want to ask your tutor, who's hiring, who can I go to? But if they don't know who does sustainability, you're basically at a loss.
Yeah.
So with this, it's become a kind of community of people who can just, you can ask for help, and asking for help is not taboo. You can hold your hand up and say, I have no idea what to do. And there's no judgment about it. It's just very relaxed and very informal. And as part of that, there's a feedback mechanism. So every single time we host one, we collect all the kind of from students, like, what did you take away from this? Why did you come? Is this valuable? How could we improve this for you? Mm-hmm. And then the tutors on the inverse, they start to identify running themes and what needs to be taught a bit better, and what, in their view, what is the kind of average understanding. So I was able to pull four of these kind of different ones together from two cities. So I did three in Glasgow, one in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of 20, 30-page report just very concisely brought together what students thought was missing, what these professionals had identified wasn't being taught very well or wasn't taught at all, how were the briefs detailed enough, were they acknowledging climate change, what did the students want to learn? And in Scotland, there's been the reception from the schools of architecture has been, from the heads of the school, has been very warm. So we've through the RIS Sustainability Working Group, we've had like meetings with the heads of schools, and they've read the reports. They've not totally ignored them. They had this alternative school of architecture that just off its own back decided, I'm going to compile this because we need to just do it. We just need to get stuck in. There's no, the science says there is no time for delays or dilly-dallying around. So went and kind of pulled all this together. And now I've got schools in England saying, we really want to see that. Can we use it? We don't know where to start. What should we do? And I have students from Australia, from Canada, and saying, we've seen what you're doing in Scotland. How do we do this here? And it's always just so surprising that I didn't set out for this to be a job. I set out for it to be a protest and then to try and dive back into practice again.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it's just grown, not exponentially and not incredibly but huge, but it just keeps on ticking over, and more people, I keep on getting emails from, I'm going to be a review critic for the first time in my life next week. So I'm going to be on the review panel for some students in Birmingham. So there's nice. It's just all these, so many people seem to become just enamored with the fact that there's an alternative school that's just doing things. And just if we need to learn some information, it's like, okay, I'll design a very kind of informal, very welcoming way of doing that instead of putting people's backs up. It's done in the most kind of relaxed way possible, but it's still got that very, I still set it all out as rigorously as I would any other piece of academia.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that we've got all the schools now have recommendations of what's missing, and they have now got their students, if there's a particular project that they've mentioned that, okay, this we've not really included something in this, maybe we should. And I've been asked them to give talks in the schools of architecture. So I spoke to first-year students at Glasgow School of Art for the first time, and being a guest lecturer is a little bit mad. I got invited to guest lecture at my old university by the students, and all they wanted to learn about was how can we do a kind of non-traditional practice? What do we do if we don't go straight into architecture?
Right.
So let's
talk about that a bit more. That's interesting. Oh, yeah. Is the sort of trajectory of an architectural student is they go along, they've got their part two, and then part three is in a big practice. Is that right? Generally,
it's sometimes people get them from smaller ones, but that's the business as usual trajectory. That's the you mm-hmm. graduate, you just dive into the first practice you can find, you just do your part three, then that's it.
And part three consists of
I'm going to give away how much I've learned here.
Yes. You haven't done your part three.
So I've not done my part three, and I'm not in the process of it. It's just you do. There's some kind of the explanation given to me is sort of like a driving test. You get kind of interviewed, and you've got to do a kind of question of a situation in practice. How would you deal with that? And it kind of builds. It shows your competency, and you've got to demonstrate that you can. That you can demonstrate you're up to being an architect, and you can keep on top of all the things that are required of you in that capacity.
Uh-huh.
So the kind of traditional trajectory is that you just, as fast as possible, you just dive straight in, you work anywhere. But it's just, I found that when I've been looking for jobs and I really want to work somewhere that's ethically and sustainably, like the environment's on their radar.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be surprised at, sometimes sustainability is one word on the practice website, and that is as far as it goes. And
yes, that sort of token word.
Or it's I've seen signatories of Architects Declare give their practice members reusable bottles and call it environmental responsibility. Like, it's the greenwash is everywhere.
So the students, there's a hunger from the students to do something differently, is there?
Yeah, because they're kind of from the students that kind of, as I went through the education, because I went and learned kind of on site and I did other things. And when I have been in practice, I worked at John Gilbert Architects in Glasgow, and they really specialise in sustainable building, conservation, do some passive house. And I had a really non-traditional part one. So I wasn't, lots of friends of mine, when they did their part one, it was, I did drainage details or I did window scheduling. Mm-hmm. I was working on energy efficiency, conservation, hybrid projects on Basil Spence housing in Edinburgh. Uh-huh. And some really kind of really fun. I had so much fun. Like in my part one, I learned more in an afternoon than I would in like 2 years of uni.
Yeah.
And it was this really, really great environment where everyone was really openly passionate about what they were good at, and you could just ask questions. And even just sitting working away on what I was doing, I've been learning lots from going on around the room. And then coming back into university and finishing off, I was doing other just odd bits and pieces on the side. Like, I've done some research assistant work, I've just done a little bit of freelance kind of architecture, like just when things need done. And just doing what I do is somehow accidentally making a job out of education and working on the kind of sustainability side and the kind of making, blending activism and practice and using what I do to make a point.
Sure. And
students are really hungry. They want their work to be meaningful, and they want to show a recognition for the environment. They don't want to be building unsustainable buildings when they know how bad the climate emergency is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not laid out to you in your education. You're not kind of shown, here are the groups you should go and talk to meet architects who are practicing sustainably, and here's where you should go to learn. It's just kind of left to the student, and there's a real hunger for it, which is just kind of exploding. There's a group, Architecture Education Declares,
mm-hmm.
where like 2,000 students have pretty much said, like, our curriculum is not teaching us. We want, this has to improve. And that's 2,000 students. And then when I was asked, like, can you please not focus on practice when you speak to us? So we want you to come and give us a talk, and we want to just hear about the weird stuff.
So like, what's the weird stuff?
The weird stuff was the kind of like, okay, I didn't get a part one position, I'm going to go and build with some straw, or I did quite.
Right. So the inspiration to break out of their little funnel of education. So I shouldn't say little funnel. That sounds condescending. To break out of their funnel of education.
I think I might have to quote that at some point. Fantastic. Yeah, there's wait, and when you're in. Like in university, some of the very best kind of points where you learn are the kind of the live, they call it the live build. So the kind of the projects are live. So you get places like the Ghost Project in Nova Scotia was a very like hands-on teaching by making course that was kind of run by McKaylee on Sweet Apple. And things like that, students, absolutely, it's the one of the best experiences to physically make something.
Yeah,
and it just it sticks with you more. It's inspiring, and the learning by doing, and even if it's not the most kind of beautiful thing in the world, anything that you're doing. So one thing that's not currently taught that much is retrofit.
Yeah,
as a kind of thing. So we've got this. We need to retrofit 1,000 homes every single day to meet Paris targets, but we are not currently doing 1,000 homes, and they're not preparing architecture students to do that. So a simple example I suggested to Edinburgh Uni when I was doing a talk as part of one of their panel discussions was, why don't you use your ongoing refurbishment as just a massive teaching resource? And that could be incredible for students, because they're currently, they'll get to know how the buildings work, they'll get to do physical kind of construction and hands-on. And the response instantly from educators is, there's no space for that. Our curriculum is full. We are teaching enough. I'm like, but if you, I don't think you are. There's definitely some gaps there. And the surprising thing there was a hand went up in the audience and a practitioner said, actually, in my practice, we have done this in universities in England where students doing site visits and working with contractors and working with professionals, it improves the quality of a building and it gives them an incredibly rich experience. And they're so much more likely to pursue more technical aspects of architecture, and they become more competent and proficient. But that's not something that the kind of traditional, the traditional education is much more focused on the end of year exhibition than it really is about kind of, do you understand how buildings work? Which is just seems counterproductive when you're training architects.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what you said about retrofit is very, very important, especially because it's so easy to detail a retrofit wrong and cause more problems than you've actually fixed. And you know, not insulating up and around the windows, you get damp spots and condensation and mold, and then the home occupants are, you know, miserable and ill. Yeah, I mean, it's a thing that we have to be doing to every home, every, well, do I mean just home? Maybe every building. Mm-hmm. That's maybe contentious.
Yeah, there's a really nice way of putting it I've heard, where there's been suggestions we should look at all of our buildings as kind of public infrastructure, because they're going to last decades, and to not retrofit them and to not kind of bring them up to standard, we're just literally throwing heat out windows, walls, roofs, and it's not healthy for people. Like, the people's built environment is so impactful on health. So 40% of all of, well, 40% of the money that any country spends on their healthcare costs is directly attributable to the built environment. So that's
incredible.
So that's such a, when you look at retrofit, it's actually an investment. You're investing in improving the health and taking weight off of health services. But this is through materials being specified that are not healthy, and people not understanding how buildings work, and having a really bad indoor air quality, or not getting enough sunlight. Like, we never got taught about how beneficial sunlight is for your health.
Right.
And which is terrifying. Like, all we got told, oh, you should naturally light a space. So I was like, okay, but why? And then there's a book called Light Revolution, and it's only about 150 pages, but it goes from kind of Roman baths and solariums all the way up to kind of like how hospitals used to have as much sunlight as possible to literally to kill bacteria and germs.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I never knew that sunlight was actually so beneficial or so necessary in that sense. Or, and then when I ever tried to bring that sort of thing into a project, and I did a project based on mental wellness, and I got told that mental wellness is a concept that isn't architecture, and it's trying to do too much. The exact quote that I got was, "It's a library, not a care home, Scott." I was just kind of, what? This is in the middle of my exam. I then said, but surely you, as an architect, you're responsible for this. And then they said, oh, but not really. And I said, then I probably said the not best words to say to your examiners, but to say, like, if an architect is not caring about the mental health of the people going to use their buildings, they're fundamentally failing as an architect. And they just kind of stopped and was like, are you going to like stand by that? I was like, yes, I'm going to stand by that, which is probably not going to help me pass. But I all of a sudden, I was not so much hitting a kind of a subjective wall. I was hitting a wall of, we don't think mental health care is architecture.
Mm.
It's like, wow, this is totally mad. So
especially, you know, physical health care, you know, like making sure that people have enough headroom when they walk upstairs and, you know, things like yeah. that, you know, that's part of architecture, but mental health, not. It's quite behind the times, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Even on that same exam, I got the kind of very memorable quote of, I got quizzed on, oh, but you've done a spiral staircase. How are drunk people going to use your library? I was like, what? Are you joking? I'm like, no, I'm very serious. But what if the person using your library is drunk? What if they fall and injure themselves? I'm like, that's ridiculous. Like, this has nothing to do with architecture. And they just kept piling on. And this is the sort of, that's what happens in the sort of design crit. We just get this hyper-destructive, it's not very constructive the way that it's done traditionally. Mm. Like, I think I've had two exams where it's not gone to like almost arguments because they refuse to believe things exist or they don't know how buildings work. I had to teach a head of year once how to heat large buildings that are industrially sized because he didn't know what a heated ceiling was.
Right.
And I was like, you're teaching students, you have 100 students, you're responsible for the education of 100 students and you don't know how to heat a large space. And my mind kind of blew, and I then got told it's incredibly rude to quote your dissertation to somebody. I was like, I'm sorry I've done like 6 months of research on this and know that I'm right.
So what's the future? Like, how's this going to get better?
Future is, a lot of it is coming from it's grassroots and through kind of research and practice. So there's, the amazing thing is that the last year has been such a catalyst for networking and people to meet each other. So there's lots happening across borders. There's lots happening kind of within countries. So like even in Scotland, they're reviewing the whole curriculum for architectural education. And there's an ongoing discussion between all five schools to kind of, how is this going to get better? In England, there's sort of similar conversations happening everywhere. There are more people are doing things than just providing education. So like as soon as there was the lockdown, there was some people started doing virtual studios and offering mentoring, just immediately saying, okay, I will teach students. I want to help people.
Yeah.
And I think there is going to have to be an addresso of the kind of, we've got this kind of code of conduct for an architect, and that really has to bring in the kind of moral imperative to do no harm to people and planet. So that the do no harm has to become our new baseline. So sustainability can no longer be about damage control. It has to be about not just doing no harm, but doing more good for the planet and doing more good for people. Mm-hmm. So we need to kind of look at how we're, the language we're using and what we're kind of, how do we place our work. We need to start looking at the incredibly long term, not just, okay, we're going to give a building a 50 to 65 year lifespan. It has to be, okay, this has to be 200 years, 300 years. Like, we've got tenements in Glasgow where I live that are plus a 200 years old, and they are incredibly lovely buildings to be in, and they last. They can be repaired. They can just be kept up. Mm-hmm. But then we've got housing being thrown up today that's, you're lucky if it gets to kind of like 5-10 years without something going gloriously wrong. So it has to be kind of there will be lots of, I think, activism in architecture is finally waking up again. It's no longer just a kind of a fringe sort of element. There is now, activism is getting into the kind of mainstream practice, mainstream education, and it's picking up a lot of speed to the kind of the activist side and people just kind of saying that this things have to change in the face of climate change and the climate crisis. There's no longer, like, business as usual is just not an option. Like, we cannot continue doing this.
Thank you, Scott, for being a wonderful guest. Thank you, Building Sustainability Heroes, for subscribing and buying me food. If that was your first episode, then make sure you subscribe. Go back and hear the other 28 episodes. Big news is that we are in the UK education podcast charts. We've been floating around the 150 to 200 position. So thank you all for listening. Feel free to share this podcast with your friends and loved ones. Maybe tweet about it. Or share one of the episode quotes I pop on my social media feeds. Or just continue to have a lovely day. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.